with this videotape, we invite you to join us at Congregation Shomrei Emunah of Baltimore during its Tisha B'Av services on Tisha B'Av 5758, 1997. For 10 years, we have tried to make the day of Tisha B'Av a meaningful experience for all of our congregants. We begin, of course, with the standard tefillah, and then we recite the kinos, but only selected kinos, which are thoroughly explained and commented on at length. Over the years, I've developed a style of relating the kinos to contemporary concerns, to the Holocaust, to the Jewish historical experience, and to the inner spiritual and ethical world of the Jew. In the afternoon, we show a selection of films on topics relevant to everything that Tisha B'Av represents. In this video, we invite you to share one section of this experience. We present to you a version of excerpts of comments on the kinos, the lamentations of Tisha B'Av. Shomrei Emunah is in the Jewish community of Baltimore, and many constituents of the general community attend this session every Tisha B'Av, so that the audience is of many hundreds of men and women, of elderly people and of young children, whom you will see in the background of this video. Shomrei Emunah is a member synagogue of the Orthodox Union, and we wish to thank Rabbi Moshe Krupka for all of his efforts in initiating and encouraging the editing and publicizing of this video. And thanks go, of course, to Rabbi Raphael Butler, Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union, for his inspiration in this entire undertaking. Those of you who are familiar with the teachings of Harav HaGaon Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik Zatzal will recognize many of his ideas incorporated in my remarks. However, I often try to go beyond his remarks to apply them, to expand upon them, and to interpret them. And so the final product is a blend of his insights which serve as an impetus for a broader perspective. I also draw upon the works of many other Gedolei Yisrael, past and present, some of whom are mentioned in the tape and some of whom are not. But of course, they all remain my personal inspiration. We hope that this videotape helps to enhance your experience of Tisha B'Av, to give it greater depth and greater meaning, in the ultimate hope that out of a deeper and more serious sense of mourning, sense of loss, and sense of appreciation for all that the Jewish people have suffered in their horrible galus, we will merit the Geula Shleima, the total and final redemption. I'd like to begin by setting the tone for the entire morning with a shir. It's true that on Tisha B'Av one doesn't learn Gemara, but this Gemara, you will agree with me, one can study on Tisha B'Av.
We focus on this Gemara and try to make it the theme of everything we discussed this morning. It's a Gemara to be found in the Seches Brochos, Tachlan Abeis, and Abeis, with a series of statements attributed to Rabbi Lozer. This is Rabbi Lozer Ben Kedos, the number two student of Rabbi Yochanan. I'm Rabbi Lozer, Yom Shechorei Beis HaMikdash, Nisika Chomat Barzel Ben Yisroel Lavihem Shebashonayim. From the day the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, an iron wall, an iron curtain, an iron choma, separates the Jewish people from their Father in Heaven. Shenemar, he quotes the pasuk, pasuk in Yecheskel, the ato kach lecho machavas barzel, you Yecheskel, take a metal pan, a metal plate, the nosata osa kir barzel, and place it as an iron wall between you and between the city. That's the entire passage. Rashi says that this Kir Barzel, this wall, which Yecheskel, symbolic wall, which Yecheskel was to have placed between him and the city, was a simon u'mechitzas barzel, a symbol of the iron curtain, and the sekes veinolo veinom, who separates he, God, and us. It's always important when Chazal quote a pasuk to consult the pasuk, to open up the Sefer Yecheskel, and to see exactly what the story is and what is the significance. How did Chazal understand it? How did they derive this powerful symbol of a chomas barzel, of an iron curtain between us and God? How did they derive it from that pasuk? And what might it mean, especially what might it mean to us living in the 90s, you know, 1990s? The pasuk appears in chapter 4, Chapter Dalad, the Navi Yecheskel. Yecheskel, you know, was a concentration camp inmate. Yecheskel was a prisoner of war. Yecheskel saw his visions on alien soil, on Babylonian soil, on the shores of the Babylonian River. You can imagine that he was wearing the uniform of Auschwitz, hundreds, thousands of years before Auschwitz. But sitting upon that river, he had his visions. Before he became a prisoner of war, he had visions in Eretz Yisrael, visions in Yerushalayim. And one of these visions that he had reads as follows. The Atzor Ben Adon, and you, mortal man, says God speaking to Yecheskel, kach lechol aveinu, take for yourself a brick. A brick, you must assume that this is a moist brick, a clump of clay, because he was now about to be charged to mold a sculpture, to sculpt a sculpture from this brick. The God tells Yecheskel to take a levena, v'mosata osa lefonecho, and put it in front of you, v'chakosa olecho ir, and engrave, sculpt, out of this block of clay, sculpt the city. Which city? Es Yerushalayim. Make a model of Yerushalayim. V'mosata olecho matzor, make a whole display, make a model of the city, and make a matzor, make a siege around the city. Make little toy soldiers, Babylonian soldiers, dress and their armor, with their weapons, besieging Yerushalayim. That's all part of the sculpture.
Uva'anisa oleha doyek,
and build towers against it. Doyek are towers which were used by besieging armies, from which to catapult rocks and stones onto the cities that they were besieging. Build those towers.
Mishofachta oleha solala,
and cast a mound against it. Ancient times, the armies that would surround the besieged city would try to mount the walls of the city. And to do that, they would take huge mounds of earth and pile them up near the walls so that they could mount those mounds and jump over the walls. So I want you, God says to Yechezkel, to make those mounds too. Kemosaka oleha machanos, and pitch camps against it. So we have now a whole display, the city of Yerushalayim, besieging armies, towers, mounds, camps. Sin oleha chorim sofif, and bring up battering rams round about it. The chorim are referred to elsewhere as the kane barzel, the iron rams, the iron horns that were used to pound against the walls of the city that was being attacked. So Yechezkel is told to build this sculpture. And then he's told, Yata kach lecha machavas barzel, then take an iron machavas, an iron pan, P-A-N, the nosata osa kir barzel, and make this iron pan as if it was a metal wall, an iron wall, bein cho bein ho'ir, between you and the city. And set your face against it. In other words, you stand on the outside of this metal wall, and the metal wall is between you and Yerushalayim. For Hoysov Amatzor, so Yerushalayim is again besieged, but this time not besieged by the model Babylonian army, but rather by you, you Yechezkel, but Sarto Oleva. You shall besiege it. Oath he revenge Israel. This shall be an oath, a sign, an omen for the house of Israel. Now what's happening here? Imagine the scene. You can picture it in your mind. Yechezkel is being told to make this model in which there are two sieges taking place. One is the siege of the Babylonian army under the Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuzaradan, besieging Yerushalayim. And for that, there's no metal wall. It's just the wall of Yerushalayim. But then there's another wall in the form of a metal plate. And that's Yechezkel's wall. Yechezkel is besieging that wall. Yechezkel on Ovi is trying to pound on that wall and somehow get pierce that metal frying pan. And come to Yerushalayim. What's happening here? What's happening is this. Yerushalayim is besieged because it does not listen to the words of the Navi. The reason why Yerushalayim is in trouble is because there is a metal wall that it itself has erected that does not allow it, does not allow her, does not allow Yerushalayim to hear the words of the Navi. The Navi's on the other side of the fence. The Navi's on the other side of the Mechitza Shel Barzel. And the Navi's trying to get through. Trying to get his word through. Trying to penetrate the Machavas with the Dvar Hashem. But he can't do it. And the Ribono Shel Olam says to him, keep trying. Keep trying. Pounding on that metal wall. Keep pounding and pounding and pounding on it. This is an ongoing sign. This is the way it is throughout the generations. Navi tried to get his word through the metal barrier, but it's very, very difficult. But the Navi has to keep trying. What is this metal choma, this metal wall? which doesn't allow the word of the Navi through to the people of God. Is it really a frying pan? Is it really an iron curtain? There are several things that it is. Number one, it's gavra. Arrogance, gavra, pride. The reason why we can't hear Yechezkel trying to get in, trying to get his message through to us, is because we think, ani ba'asi oz, I know best. Because Yechezkel is a madman. He's a schizophrenic, he's a psychotic, he's hallucinating, he's seeing visions. I know better, I'm wiser. He's too wild. He's spending his time playing with clay sculptures. I'm more sophisticated. I know better than the Navi. It's that attitude of gavra which doesn't allow this message in. And that attitude persists throughout history. We don't want to hear the word of our Naviim. We don't want to hear the word of our God, of our Torah, of our teachers, of our elders. Because of gavra. We think we know better. The most tragic aspect of gavra is the refusal to admit that we were wrong. The inability to say, I made a mistake. I was wrong. I meant well, but I was wrong. That gavra epitomized in daily life. The inability to say to one's spouse, you know, you were right, I was wrong. The inability to say to one's rabbi or to say to one's congregation, you were right, I was wrong. That's gavra. That's the behavioral description of gavra. The Musaf Svarim are full of all sorts of descriptions of what gavra is. But that's what it boils down to in daily life. The inability that we all have, I'm certainly no better than anyone else on this one, the ability to say, I was wrong. And that gets us into such trouble, it's amazing. I don't want to wax political here, but I don't think this is politics. The inability for people to say, Oslo Accords, peace process, we made a mistake. Right? We meant well. We thought maybe this would work. We tried. Who's going to say, no, we made a mistake. Right? Made a mistake. Let's go right there. Let's change. The inability in community life. American Jewish community, Baltimore Jewish community, the Shomeruna Jewish community. To say, we tried certain approaches, we were wrong, let's reevaluate, let's reassess, maybe we made a mistake. That inability that we all have, that's a mechita shel barzel. That's an iron wall that prevents the word of Yechezkel from coming in. So that's one aspect of mechita shel barzel, which is certainly alive and well in the 90s. There's another mechita shel barzel, and that's perhaps less malicious. I think God was malicious. I know better. I'm right. There's some malice in that. But there's another metal wall, another iron wall, which is usually not malicious. And that simple habit and routine. This is me. This is the way I've always done it. It's too late to change. Too difficult to change. Habit, routine. It's a mechita shel barzel. It's a metal wall. Doesn't allow us to hear the words of Yechezkel. Yechezkel's knocking on the frying pan on the other side. And he's saying, change. And we're saying very visibly, it's hard to change. Change means uprooting all my friends. Change means dressing differently, speaking differently, spending my time differently. It's too hard to change. It's impossible to change. Human nature can't change. Rav Kook, a beautiful passage, speaks about this. This difficulty to change. He calls it a stubbornness, an abshanut. And he writes, Ha'akshanus la'amot tamid b'deya achas. Ulehitamech bo b'chevle ha'chatas sh'na'asu l'minhag. Bein d'na'asim, bein b'deya. The stubborn determination to remain with the same opinion and to invoke it in support of a disposition to which one has become habituated, whether in action or in opinion. This is true of all of us. All of our opinions, all of our attitudes, all of our actions are basically based upon sameness. This is what I've been doing for the past 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. I'm going to still do it this way. Why change? That attitude, writes Rav Kook, he machalo habo mitoch shikua ba'altos kosher. This is an illness which results from a grievous enslavement that does not permit the light of penitence to shine in full strength. It's an illness to always do things the same way, not to reconsider, not to reassess, not to think, maybe I should be thinking differently. Maybe I should open myself up to some other way of thinking, another way of doing. That's an attitude. That attitude is an illness. Ki hatshuva shal efes lechofesh nekodi amiti, shiru hachofesh ha'eloki, she'ein imo shum avdus. It's a slavery. You're enslaved by your past opinions. And that's not what tshuva is. Tshuva is the aspiration to be free. Where there's no enslavement. Not even the enslavement of one's previous beliefs and customs. So that's Mechita Shabbazal number 2. Mechita Shabbazal number 3, we are borrowing directly from a salvation. Mechita Shabbazal number 3 is a false sense of security. We say, Ani amati b'shalvi b'hal emot l'olam. There's one phrase in this siddur which really characterizes us. Us, I mean, American Jews living in 1997, middle class, affluent society, blah, blah, blah. It's that pasuk. Ani amati b'shalvi. When I was at peace, I said, b'hal emot l'olam. I will never be shaken. We all said, take Bishop, we're all fasting, sitting on the floor, wearing sneakers. We're still saying that. You know, things will go by tonight, I'll have a meal, it'll be great, tomorrow back to work, everything will be fine, wonderful. Nothing can really shake me. I'm fine, I'm healthy, I'm wealthy, I'm wise. Nothing's going to shake me. That's honestly, that's everyone's attitude here in this room. Everyone. Ani amati b'shalvi b'alam azayolam. That's a mechita shabaza. That's an iron curtain between us and the Cheskel. And we shouldn't be that way. We should realize that our wealth can vanish in a moment. Our health might at this moment be not what we think it is. Who knows what kind of disease process is going on within us at this moment that we'll find out about tomorrow or next week. That will just completely smash all of our dreams and turn our lives upside down. And even our wisdom. You know, who knows what sorts of mental stress, financial stress, physical stress might come along and wipe our minds clean of all of our knowledge and all of our wisdom. There's a Gemara earlier in Brachos, that's Tesayin in the faith. Rebbe, Losatz lo say, Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Hanosi, Judah the Prince, Omar, Hochi, when he finished davening, he used to say it follow. We say it much earlier in the davening. He said it at the end of his davening. This is his prayer. You're familiar with this. Yiratonu fanecha Hashem Elokeinu Elokei Adoseinu. May it be your will, God, the God of our fathers. Shetatzileinu me'adzei fronim. Please spare me from brazen people. May Azus Panim from brazenness. May Adam Ra from evil men. May Pegara from evil events. May Yetzahara from evil inclinations. May Chavara from evil friends. May Shochan Ra, evil neighbors. May Satan HaMashchis from a destructive Satan. May Din Kosher, difficult, arguments, he bowed in pressure from difficult opponents. Ben Shehu ben Bris, Ben Sheenu ben Bris, whether he's a Jewish opponent, a non-Jewish opponent. This prayer was written by Rebbe. So Soloveitchik says, in such an eloquent way, Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, think of who he was, the most powerful Jew of his time, the king of the Jews. Think of who his friends were. Rebbe's best friend was Antoninus, the great Roman general. So Rebbe had the most powerful ally that a human being could possibly have. So he is praying, God, spare me from a chavera, spare me from a baal din kasha. He's the most powerful of men. He calls the shots. He's so wealthy, the Gemara says, he had on his table radishes and melons all year long. Right? What wasn't available in Eretz Yisrael, he imported from China or from Spain or from who knows where. Most wealthy of men, the most powerful of men, the most wise of men, the editor, the author of the Mishnah. And he's praying that God spare me from some azikonim, from some chutzpahnik who's liable to insult me. Rashi says, what's the other's ponim? What's the brazenness that he's afraid of? Rashi says, Shlo yotziu olai laz mamzerus. People shouldn't start a rumor that I am a bastard. People shouldn't start a rumor that I am a mamzer. This is Rebbe, alright? Rebbe is direct descendant from David HaMelech, the son of Rav Shimon, the grandson of Rabbi Gamliel, right? We can trace his lineage back. You want to go a few generations back, it's Rabbi Gamliel Azokin. A few generations earlier, it's Hillel. Generations earlier, it's David. People are going to come and accuse him of being a mamzer, accuse him of being illegitimate. What's going on here? The Gemara concludes the story. And Rebbe was praying, don't get me into trouble with a bad neighbor or a bad friend. Afogaf the kaimi kitsutse olei the Rebbe. Rashi says, shohoyu shotrim. Omdim, the mitzvah Antoninus. Antoninus, the Roman general, second to the Caesar, Antony. He appointed special guards. He sent Roman legionaries to be Rebbe's personal guard. He was thought up with Rebbe. Antoninus' Gestapo agents would get you. And Rebbe is still praying, spare me from a bad neighbor. That's what Soloveitchik says. You have a bad neighbor, throw him out. You have all the power in the world at your disposal. The answer is, I suggest with elevation, that Rebbe was aware that no matter how secure you think you are not secure. The legions of Rome won't protect you necessarily. All of your lineage might be called into question. All of your power might vanish in a day. You're vulnerable. Life is fragile. And suggests elevation. Precisely in that thing that you think you're most secure with, that's what you have to pray most for. You're most secure, Rebbe, you're most secure with your armed God, with Antoninus' legionnaires protecting you, you better pray you don't get a shochen ra. Rebbe, you're secure with your yichus. I am the great grandson of Rabbi Gamliel. I am the Nasi. I am the embodiment of Malchus Yisrael, Malchus Yehuda. That's what you're proud about. That might be called into question. Tomorrow someone will come up and accuse you of being a mamzer. What you're most secure with is what you have to pray for the most. So the Soloveitchik said, it's so poignant when you hear this, because he made this talk about 30 years ago now. He says, for example, me, you have Soloveitchik. I feel pretty secure. I'll never be an Amoritz. I learn Gemara every day. I'll never become an ignoramus. I have to pray that I never suffer from a disease that will wipe out all my knowledge. He said this 10, 15 years before he suffered a disease which rendered him shivering. And the very thing which you're most confident, that's what you have to pray for the most. But we tend not to do that. We tend to feel confident. I have yichus, I have protection, I have American government, I have a free country, I have a job, I have a fine family, I have my health, etc., etc., etc. Nothing can harm me. Ani amati b'shalvi, b'alem lo t'yolam. That's the Mechita Shabbat. Only when you pray, Yirasam l'fanecha, Shetatzileini, Me'odam lo, Shochan lo, Misotna mashtet, we realize how vulnerable we are, then we can hear Yechezkel pounding on the other side of the metal frying pan. Yechezkel, by the way, means the Navi Yechezkel. It means all Nevi'im of Am Yisrael. It means every Rav down through the ages stands on the other side of a Mechita Shel Bazel and pounds and tries to get his message across. Every Mechanech, every teacher, stands on the other side of the Mechita Shel Bazel and pounds away. Every parent pounds away, pounds away. And every person to himself or to herself pounds away at a Mechita Shel Bazel. The point of it is that there's only one way to get through the Mechita Shel Bazel, and that is to keep on pounding. Yechezkel was told, V'tzarta olav, keep laying siege to the Mechita Shel Bazel. One day you'll get through. Keep pounding away. Where there is a Beit HaMikdash, what is a Beit HaMikdash? It's just some beautiful building, some beautiful archaeological remains, some beautiful imposing structure that all the world can admire. No. Beit HaMikdash was that entity which could pierce the Mechita Shel Bazel. That entity which could reduce our arrogance to humility. That entity which could reduce our habit to an openness to change and self-examination. Beit HaMikdash is that which could make us realize our vulnerability and cry out to Ribono Shel Olam in a sincere, sincere way. A base tefillah b'chol ha'amim. That's what the Beit HaMikdash was, and that's what we mourn. We mourn the fact that we have this Mechita Shel Bazel, and we can't penetrate them without a Beit HaMikdash. We can't penetrate them on Tisha B'Av. When Tisha B'Av we come closest to capturing that Beit HaMikdash, to recapturing. Kol HaMisadol on Yerushalayim, Zocha V'Roa, V'Simchasa. If we properly mourn in Yerushalayim, we can rebuild it. And when we rebuild it, we will penetrate and perhaps one time finally eradicate the Mechita Shel Bazel, the iron curtain, the Chomer Shel Bazel, that separates us from Avinu Shebashamayim. Eicha Atzah V'Yatzecha. As we approach it, let's keep front and center in our minds the image of Mechita Shel Bazel, the Chomat Bazel, a metal wall which is our own personal armor. And part of that armor is resistance to change, habit, same old stuff. I'm secure. Nobody can possibly defeat me. I'm okay. That's the Mechita Shel Bazel. How do you get past it? One of the powers of poetry, even secular poetry, is the use of language, the ability to use language to get behind that psychological barrier that each of us has. When we hear ordinary words or prose, they bounce off our armor. But sometimes a speaker can find a phrase which will strike a note that wakes us up, that gets behind the barrier. And that's what poetry does. The poet tries to say things in ways that haven't been heard before, in ways that might be new, that might get the listener's attention, that might get behind his defenses. That's what poetry is all about. When we speak of poetry, especially those of us who are trained in most yeshivas that I know, you know, poetry is something kind of had to study to get by the English course or New York State where I went to high school to pass the Regents. And we fail to realize the tremendous poetry in our own tradition. The poetry of Chazal, the poetry of Tanakh, the poetry of the Siddur, poetry of the Slichos,
And today, the poetry of the Kinos. It's poetry in every sense of the word, but especially in its ability to get behind the iron wall, to get over, under, through, behind the iron wall. And in the next Kinos, Echa Atta Bapecha, Raza HaKaliyah does it in a few ways. First of all, by the constant repetition of letters. Notice the first stanza. Echa Atta Apecha La Abei Biat Adomim Emunecha Aleph, 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 Aleph. This catches us, especially when we realize what it means. How have you hastened in your wrath to destroy your trusted ones, the faithful ones, in the hands of the Romans? But look at any of the stanzas. For example, the second. Ozachata Berith Bain Habisarim Asher Berata Levichunecha Vachain Bitinu. Again and again, that days hammers home the fact of how God could you not remember the covenant, the Berith Bain Habisarim, which you chose for your chosen ones, for your tested ones, for those who have stood by you. And therefore we express ourselves and say, Zechor Hashem HaYolona, which is the refrain. We'll look at the hay. Echa Hagto, the Hegyonecha, Lahadof, Biad Hodolim, Hamonecha. How could you plan in your schemes, O God, to beat down your masses in the hands of these cynics, of these scoffers and mockers? Velozacharta, how could you not remember? Viyud, Vesek, Veses, Asher Viyadatol of Viyudecha. How could you not remember the Beis Hamikdash, which is called the Viyud Vesek, the tried and true place of assembly? Veses, the place which we would visit periodically. Asher Viyadatol, which you chose with Viyudecha for your chosen ones. So the Vav gets its point across. And again, letter for letter. That's one of the powers of the poetry. The repetition of letter, letter, bays, 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 hammering away at the iron curtain until it's heard on the other side. But there's another way that this kinnah gets behind the iron curtain. This kinnah is very daring. It's in a way almost brazen. This kinnah challenges God. God, how could you do this? How could you do this? Echa atta ba'apecha. How often do you hear Jews, at least in the liturgy, questioning God, challenging God? Echa, how could you do it? How could you not remember? How could you abandon us, your faithful people? How could you abandon us, your people upon whom you have mercy, your sheep, your children, your vineyard, your witnesses? How could you abandon us and give us over to be trampled and burned and raped and stepped upon by these vicious enemies, haters, scoffers, cynics, etc.? It's a questioning, questioning kingdom. In the 18th kinnah, which we'll pause at momentarily when we reach it, we question. Normally, the Jewish response to catastrophe, the Jewish response to God's wrath, is tzidduk hadin. Tzadik Hashem b'chol d'rochov. Hatzur tamim po'olo. You say, God, you know better. You're right. We're wrong. And we'll say that too. We'll say that too. But in Kinos, we allow ourselves to question God. And I want to say something about this, because one of the themes that we have to address on Tisha B'Av is the religious response to catastrophe. How does a religious person, a ma'amin, a believer in God, respond to the tragedy of the Churban Beis Hamikdash, respond to the horror of the Holocaust? Was there a religious response b'shas ma'isa? Was there a religious response at the moment of the catastrophe? What was its nature? And what should the religious response be now? And here's how I answer it. and this is my answer. Everything we're reading about is a religious response. There's only one response which is not religious, and that is indifference, forgetfulness, shikacha. Saying, well, it happened, so we'll go on with our lives. That's the only response which is not religious. Not to remember, that's not religious. But everything else that we do that has to do with remembering, even if it's questioning God, even if it is denying God, but if it's remembering, it's religious. There are poets, Yiddish poets, Gladstein, Hebrew poets, Alterman, who say, since the Holocaust, I can no longer pray. I can't pray to a God who would allow one-third of his people to be killed. I can't pray. To me personally, that is a religious response. That's saying there is a God, I don't understand him, I'm angry with him, I refuse to pray to him, but that's still a religious response. To say, well, it happened, koro mikre, let's go further, that's not a religious response. But to be angry even to the point of saying I won't pray anymore, that's also a religious response. In Echa, how many psukim say, Sosam tefilosi, me'avor tefilosi, our prayers are not heard, they can't be heard, they won't be heard. It's not the ideal religious response, but it still is a religious response. And it's a question to ask God, why did you do it? How could you do it? I can't understand it. I refuse to understand it. That's even a higher level religious response. That's the response of this kinnah. God, how could you do it? Echa atta be'apecha. Let's look at the Samach. Echa sachto b'sa'arecha. How could you speak in your wrath? The sager, to close in. B'yad se'afim, in the hands of evil schemers. Sahadecha, your witnesses. Of all the appellations that are given in this kinnah, for Am Yisrael, we're called God's vineyard, God's sheep, God's hamon, God's geulim, God's bechunim. The most powerful one is Sahadecha, your God's witnesses. Chazal, it says this in the beginning of Maseches Chagiga, you may be familiar with, and says indeed, the Jewish people are the witnesses to the Shabbos and to God. The Shabbos is the witness to God and the Jewish people. God is the witness to Shabbos and the Jewish people. But the main point is we're witnesses. In there with Shabbos Kodesh and the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. We're all witnesses for each other. But witness, the word witness, carries with it a certain theological significance that you may not be aware of. And that is that our, what should we say, our daughter religions, Islam and Christianity, refer to us, refer to the Jewish people as God's witnesses. We have a kingdom in the world for them because we are witnesses to God. There's a downside and an upside to that. The downside is it places a heavy burden on us. The upside is it makes them deal with us. It forces them to deal with us theologically, politically, and every other way. And that's how we've been dealt with, as witnesses. And it took National Socialism, Nazism, to say, no, they're no longer witnesses. They're better dead than alive. But we persisted for centuries in Christian-dominated countries, persecuted, not tolerated, discriminated against, penned into ghettos, etc. But we persisted because the church felt these are God's witnesses. There was a certain redeeming quality to that. So we've not heard sufficiently and still don't hear it, is that the Goyim are waiting for us to be God's witnesses. They're waiting for us to show that we can be God's people, that we can show the way in ethics and morality, in religion, in worship and prayer. They're looking to us to be his witnesses. And we failed. And it's no wonder then sometimes that I think the answer to this question, why God did you give your witnesses over to these seyafim, is because we weren't such good witnesses. We don't testify enough.
even when we do testify, we do it in private, in ways that the goyim don't know about it, ways that the goyim doesn't get into the headlines. And when we blow it, we do our misdeeds, we do it in ways which undermine our ability to be a witness, because we do shameful things which do make the headlines. And here we come to the tragic figure of Yoshiyahu HaMelech, of the King Yoshiyahu. There's much to be said. The kinnah is based upon the fact that the prophet, the Navi Yirmiyahu, composed a eulogy, an elegy, upon the death of Yoshiyahu. And this is described in Divrei Hayomim Beis, in Kapitel Lamed Hei. And there, Rashi, or Pirush HaMiyuchos L'Rashi, we're not quite clear, it's really Rashi, comments as follows. Kishemizdamein lohem shum tsa'aru b'chiyo. Whenever the Jewish people have any calamity or cause to cry, Sheheim mekonanim ubochim al hama'ura, when they will compose lamentations and hespedim about that event, heimazkirim zehatzar imo, they will mention, along with the pain, the grief over the death of Yoshiyahu. Dugma de Tisha B'Av. Those are the words of Rashi. Which gives us a basis in Rashi, by the way, to include in Tisha B'Av the mourning for all of the catastrophes of Jewish history, even those which were subsequent to the Churban Bayis Rishon V'Sheni, such as the Holocaust. But it's fascinating that Rashi is referring to the death of Yoshiyahu. That must always be remembered. What is it about the death of one person, one king, however great he may have been, that we must incorporate mourning for him in all of our mourning? I'd like to suggest several approaches. One approach is this. Think of 6 million. Can you think of 6 million? Can your mind imagine 6 million people? I mean, we have a fine crowd here today. About 200, 300. And we have a lot of people. We have, Baruch Hashem, a fine, shrum community in Baltimore. Are there 10,000? Maybe not. We have many Jews in Baltimore. Perhaps 80,000. And we have a difficult time imagining, picturing in our mind's eye, even the Jews here today, the Jews of our community. But 6 million? It's impossible. And therefore, what we must do is focus upon individuals. We must remember specific people to whom we can give names, to whom we can see a picture, whose shoes we can locate in a pile of shoes in a bin in Auschwitz. We must try to attach names, faces, personalities to several of the 6 million, and then we can mourn them. And this was what Yirmiyahu was doing. Yirmiyahu had a lot to cry about. Everything was falling apart. The people were about to be sent into exile. The Beit HaMikdash was about to be destroyed. He saw it all clearly. Everyone saw it all happening. And he mourned indeed, as we read last night, the whole ear Rabosiyom, the whole multitude he was able to mourn. But he knew that just mourning multitudes doesn't get you in the gut. What gets you in the gut is to focus on one person, one young person, with great potential, failed potential. Yoshiyahu. When you call name Yirmiyahu on Yoshiyahu, he focused at least one of his kinos on a specific individual. Gedola misas tzadikim kisreifas beis avotenu, the Gemara says. The death of individual tzadikim is as great as the destruction of the whole temple.
destruction of the whole temple is an overwhelming event. We can't digest it. We can't focus on it. We can't mourn it. It's too much. We can mourn this individual, that individual. When we speak of all the catastrophes and all the losses that we suffered, we'll focus upon soon 10 Haruge Malchus, 10 rabbis. And of those 10 here today, we'll focus on one, on Rabbi Akiva. When we think of all the great leaders of the Jewish people who were burned and gassed and buried alive in the Holocaust, we can think of tens of thousands of them. Today, we'll focus on Rabbi Dr. Joseph C. Kalbach, the last Rav of Hamburg. Of all the million-plus children, little children, same as the children you see right here next to me in the shul, little children, heads dashed, bellies pierced by bayonets, gassed, burned, choked, experimented upon. We'll focus on just a few of those children. We'll try to give them names and cry for each little girl and each little boy. That's Vayakone and Yirmiyahu and Yoshiyahu on one person. But what a person Yoshiyahu was. And what a tragedy his life was. Look at the potential in the first stanza. And Shmona Shona Haichel Lidrosh Melokov. When he was 8 years old, he began to seek God. His father was not a seeker of God, but he was. From the age of 8. Indeed, in the third stanza, Gimel, B'chol Malcha Yisrael Asher Komu Ligdor Lo Kom Kamohu Mimos Avigdor. Of all the Jewish kings, and that's quite a list, that includes David and Shlomo and Chizkiyahu, of all the kings, he was the greatest. There was no greater leader in Israel from the time of Avigdor. Avigdor is one of the names of Moshe Rabbeinu. So he's second to Moshe in Jewish leadership, Jewish majesty. Where was his downfall? Well, this king of probes, where did he go wrong? Why was this person who had the potential at 8 years old to be a Moshe Rabbeinu? Dalad, Bavak Bo Chet Leit Sonei Hador. Gemara says in so many different ways, Dor Lefi HaParnas, Parnas Lefi Hador. The leader reflects his following, the followers reflect their leader. Chazal realized that a leader can only lead if his people follow. And the tragedy of a great leader is when he lives in an age where his people don't understand him and can't comprehend him and ultimately frustrate his ideals. Moshe Rabbeinu was told, Lech reid ki shiches amcha. And the Gemara says, Lech reid mi gedulotcha. Moshe Rabbeinu got demoted, not because there was anything wrong with him, but ki shiches amcha, because his people, his followers, his constituency failed. And Moshe Rabbeinu did not experience nevuah for a long time, not because of any fault of his own, but because a leader gains his leadership resources from his constituency, from his followers. Yoshiyahu may have been as great as he was, potentially Moshe, but there were the Leitzomei Hador, the cynics, the mockers, the sinners of his generation, Asher Komu Achar HaDeles L'Sdor, who worshipped at Avodah Zarah behind closed doors, literally. And he, as a leader, is responsible for his followers, for what they do publicly and for what they do privately. That's the responsibilities of leadership. And here we come to another Mechitza Shel Barzel, another iron curtain. And this one I want you to hear. It's the iron curtain between Medrash and Masa. Right? We know throughout Chazal, Lo HaMedrash Hu HaIkar, El HaMasa. It's possible for a person to know all kinds of things and it doesn't translate into action. It's possible for a man to write 75 volumes of philosophy saying how important it is to be kind to your fellow man, and it doesn't mean a thing in terms of his personal behavior, because he can define fellow man as fellow German and exclude Jews or Gypsies or whatever from fellow man, and they do a little pilpul and he can do what he wants. The biggest, strongest, most impenetrable mechitza shel ba'azel is the mechitza between what we know in our mind and what we actually do. And this is true of Heidegger. This is true of all noble philosophers and scientists and men of medicine I have prepared, and I'm not going to share with you today. A history of medicine in Germany from 1933 to 1945. And I got this, Sam Ziegler showed it to me in a medical journal, not in a journal about the Holocaust, in a medical journal. What went wrong with the medical profession in Germany? People who were sworn by the Hippocratic Oath to save lives and to preserve lives, who engaged in sadistic tortures upon innocent men, women, and children. How do you understand that? In the Mechitza shel Ba'azel, between the Hippocratic Oath, study of medicine, study of philosophy, study of everything, and what I actually do. And this Mechitza shel Ba'azel exists in each of us too. We know all kinds of good things, etc., and we can still come home and abuse, verbally abuse our spouses. No? That's written in the Torah, but it's not Zekla Godol B'chayim, not necessarily a great rule in life. That's the Mechitza shel Ba'azel which we've got to break down. We've got to break down. We can't do anything about Heidegger. Right now, he's met his judge, and his judge can judge him fairly. But we have to not allow what we know. We know more than 75 books of Heidegger's writings. We know all Tanakh and all the Sifrei Musar and all the Sifrei Chazal and all the Sifrei Machshava. And we don't translate into our actions. That's the Mechitza shel Ba'azel. The difference, the key difference between our Gedolei Yisroel and others, the modern Heideggers of history, is the phrase in Pirkei Avos which reads, Shonu Chachomim B'Lshon HaMishneh Boruch She'Bocha Bohem U'V'Mishnosom. The Meir Shapiro said, Bohem U'V'Mishnosom, because all the Tzadnoim who are mentioned in Pirkei Avos, it's not just their teachings, it's them. It's them and their teachings. Whatever Shammai taught, he practiced. Whatever Hillel taught, he practiced. Whatever Meir taught, he practiced. Whatever Rekiva taught, he practiced. Bohem U'V'Mishnosom. In them and their teachings. There's no Mechitza shel Ba'azel between Bohem and the Mishnosom. And to the extent that there is a Mechitza shel Ba'azel, to the extent that we split off our noble teachings from our ignoble actions, to that extent, we are Heideggers and not Hillels. Hillel knew no schism between what he taught and what he did, between what he preached and what he did, between what he wrote and believed and what he did. It's that Mechitza shel Ba'azel which explains to me the part of the problem of how can the most advanced Western nation be so barbaric. It can split all of their advanced, high, lofty talk from their activities, from their actions. And if you can do that internal split, and we all do it, if you could do it, there's no telling where it can lead. You've got to remove that Mechitza shel Ba'azel and inform your actions with the teachings and preachings that you have. Me'acharov heviyu es Rabbi Akiva oker horim v'tochanan zo b'zo b'sfora. Rabbi Akiva, who was able to uproot mountains and grind them together, so powerful was his logic. Rabbi Akiva, the great debater, Rabbi Akiva, the great analytic thinker, the powerful thinker. They combed his flesh with an iron comb to break it. He said, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echod. And when he said the word Echod, that's when he died. And a heavenly voice went out and said, Ashrecho Rabbi Akiva, Happy are you, Rabbi Akiva, gufach tahor, b'chol minei tahora. Your body is pure with all sorts of purity. And there are the others, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bovar, Rabbi Hanina ben Trajon, Rabbi Yeshevov, Rabbi Chutzpis, Rabbi Ozef ben Shamua, and on, Kohena v'Kohena, on, the list doesn't stop. The list didn't stop with the Spanish Inquisition, didn't stop in the Crusades. I don't know many of you know this, that Rabbeinu Elchonon, one of the Balei HaTosfos, who was the son of the Ri, Ri HaZokem, the Balei HaTosfos, who was killed by the Crusaders. The great Chachmei Sfarad killed in the Spanish Inquisition. The great Achronim, early Achronim, killed in the early pogroms in the middle 1600s. And in World War II, in the Holocaust, numerous Gedolei Torah, Vachon Rassaman, Nachum Zemba, on, Kohena v'Kohena. I'd like to focus on Rabbi Akiva. Because, when you learn Gemara a lot, well, Rabbi Akiva has become just a name, important name, but just a name. And yet, his life, actually, I think we probably know more biographical data on Rabbi Akiva than we know about any other Tana. You know his wife's name, that's unusual, his name was Rochel. We know his father-in-law's name, Tal Basavua. We know a lot about his history, his early years as a bum, right? Rabbi Akiva was a bum in today's terms. An Oisvorf, an enemy of Talmidei Chachamim, terrible person. And he changed, and he modeled for us the capacity to change, to grow, and to grow from vicious opposition to the Chachamim, to grow to become the greatest. There's no limit to how one can grow when one does it as devotedly, as patiently, as I said before, like drops of water on a rock, drop by drop by drop, slowly to grow. This, of course, is Rabbi Akiva. There's a lot more to Rabbi Akiva that's less well known, that we may have to share. Rabbi Akiva hayo omed medrash eicha v'nidon lefnei punis rufus. Rabbi Akiva stood in judgment, and his judge was a Roman general named Tunis Rufus. For hayo shom Yehoshua Hagarsi, and Rabbi Akiva had a companion, perhaps a student, whose name was Yehoshua Hagarsi, not called Rabbi Yehoshua, just Yehoshua. Omeid b'tfila imo. Rabbi Akiva and Yehoshua Hagarsi sat and prayed. They were mispalo. Yorad onon v'hikifon. And as they were praying, they were surrounded by a cloud. So Yehoshua Hagarsi said, Dome ani, seems to me, Shalo yorad onon v'hikif, that this cloud descended and envelops us only kidei shalo tishoma tefiloso shel Rabbi, only so that you, my teacher, Rabbi Akiva's prayer should not be heard. Hado duchsiv sakoso be'onon loch me'avor tefilo. Posa genecho, we are enwrapped with a cloud, prayers cannot leave, prayers cannot rise, prayers are not heard. Now, it's interesting in that medrash. They were both enveloped by this cloud. Tunis Rufus was standing there. They're both in the dungeon. Akiva is about to be killed. They're both praying. And the Talmud, Yehoshua, says, Sarkosa ba'onam roch me'avor tefila. Rabbi Akiva didn't say that. As far as we know, Rabbi Akiva went on davening. Yet cloud, nish cloud, yet Tunis Rufus, nish Tunis Rufus, Rabbi Akiva's tefila continued. Because that was Rabbi Akiva. For Rabbi Akiva, there were no clouds, there were no Tunis Rufus, there was no rock. The water could make a hole in the rock. There was no Mechitza Shel Barzel. He could break that too. And he's right, Rabbi Akiva. Because we're sitting here today, 1900 plus years after Rabbi Akiva was tortured to death,
and his teachings are being read, and his sources are being analyzed, and his lesson is being emulated, and Rabbi Akiva is alive and well. And the Akiva's teachings were heard. Yeshua Garcia, his Talmud, thought that they weren't. He thought, Sakosa Banan Lachmi Avrat Filin. Rabbi Akiva took the long view. That was his approach. Patient, long view. Keep pounding on the Mechita Shel Baza. This is what he learned from his wife. He didn't have it stumped. His wife taught him that. His wife is the one who sent him away to yeshiva. He said, go off to yeshiva, I'll be alone. His wife is the one who gave up on all of her father's wealth. Her father dispossessed her and disinherited her, and she didn't care. And she stood by him because she gave him the faith in himself and in the capacity to grow and to grow and to grow and to succeed. And indeed, all of his teachings we owe to her. Rabbi Akiva himself taught us, Shali, Shalachem, Shalach. That whatever I'm teaching you, whatever you know of my teachings, Rabbi Akiva tells us down to this very day, it's all Rachel's. It's all my wife's. And it's Rabbi Akiva who knew what it meant to love a wife. Rabbi Akiva, Medrash tells us the story. When they were very poor, he and his wife slept in a stable, in a barn. They slept in the straw. And he would lovingly take the straw out of her hair. He promised her, from that moment of poverty, that one day he'd be able to afford a beautiful piece of jewelry for her. A Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, that's where the phrase comes from. He'll get her a beautiful necklace, which will have a picture of Yerushalayim on it. And he gave her that necklace. So he taught us the proper attitude to have for a spouse. He taught us how to love. And perhaps, as it's been suggested, that's why Rabbi Akiva could say, Kol Hashirim Kodesh, Shir HaShirim Kodesh Kadoshim. Whereas others might have seen in Shir HaShirim a simple love song, Rabbi Akiva saw in Shir HaShirim the holiest of holies, because he knew what love was between man and woman and how noble it was and how the love that his wife had for him led to his greatness, the encouragement. Their marriage was one which flourished and led to greatness. We don't know she lived long enough to see him imprisoned. As far as I know, I've tried to search for this. We don't see her reactions to his imprisonment in his later years. But we have many, many stories about his imprisonments. And there's one that I'd like to share with you because it helps us understand the secret of Rabbi Akiva. The love is one part of his secret, understanding of love. The other part of the secret was his persistence, his courage, the long view, the patient view. But another aspect of his secret, which we can all learn from. In the Gemara, it's a Gemara, but this story is not so well known. Tana Rabbanan Maaseh is a Gemara in Erev and Daf Chaf Aleph from the day. Tana Rabbanan Maaseh b'Rabbi Akiva shohei yechavush b'beis ha'asurim. It happened that Rabbi Akiva was imprisoned in a dungeon, a Roman dungeon. For Hoya, we have the gears of Hoya Rabbi Yehoshua HaGarsi. Sometimes this Yehoshua HaGarsi appears without the title, sometimes with the title. Here we have the title Rabbi Yehoshua HaGarsi Mishoso B'chol Yom B'Yom. This was his faithful disciple, Yehoshua. And Yehoshua came and visited Rabbi Akiva in the jail every single day. B'chol Yom B'Yom Hoyu Machnisin Lo Mayim B'Midah. Every day they would allow Yehoshua HaGarsi to take one flask of wine, measured out, one half gallon, let's say, every day, no more, the midah. Yom Echad Miso Shomer Beiso HaSurim. One day, the Roman guard saw Yehoshua trying to come in to visit Rabbi Akiva in jail. Omar Lo Hayom Neimecho Merubin. Today you've got too much water. Shema Lachtor Beiso HaSurim Atat Tzorech. Maybe you're up to some scheme. You can use the extra water to tunnel under the jail and get out of the dungeon. It's that chance. A little bit of water, you can break out of a Roman dungeon. But that was the accusation. So the guard, sadistically, cruelly, poured out half the water. He gave half the water. He said to Yehoshua, take half the water to your master. Now keep it in the dungeon. It's just about dying of thirst. Tishaboy for Rabbi Akiva. So Yehoshua came to Rabbi Akiva now with a half measure of water. Rabbi Akiva, imagine, it's in prison, it's dark. This is the prison, not like 20th century prison. This is a dungeon, dark and damp, crawling with insects and rodents and whatnot. He's finally dying of thirst and he sees Yehoshua coming, so Rabbi Akiva, of course, becomes hopeful. Oh, here's my bit of water. Instead of the usual bit of water, he has half that bit of water. Omalo Yehoshua, so he says, complainingly to Yehoshua, Heinata Yodea, Shezokeinani, don't you know that I'm an old man? V'chayai Tuluyin V'chayecha, and my life depends upon your life. Bring me more water. Sochlo Kol Oso Hama'ura. So Yehoshua told him the story. He came with more water. The God made him dump half of it. Omalo, so Rehiva said, fine. That little water which you have, give it to me. I want to wash my hands. Until I should die. Omalo, tenli mayim she'etol yodai. Give me water to wash my hands. This is not until I should die for bread. Until I should die by boker, which has a lesser halachic status. Omalo, so Yeshua said to him, Rebbe, if you've gone mad, lishtosei magiyim. There's not enough water to drink. We told yodecho magiyim. And you use the water, this little bit of water, to wash your hands with? Or Malo, Rabbi Akiva said, Moesa, what can I do? Shechayovim aleihem misa. Because the halacha is, if you don't listen to a din de rabbonon, toyeh zgeder, shechenu nochosh. So this is a din de rabbonon. My chaverim, other rabbi said, you should wash your hands every morning. I want to do it. Mutav omus misas atzmi v'lo e'avor agas chaverai. I'm not going to violate what my colleagues have said, the importance of Negavah. Omru, they say, Lo to'am klum, he wouldn't taste anything, put anything in his mouth, ad shehevi lo mayim, until he brought him the water, v'notal yodav. Kishashamu chachomim v'adofa. When the chachomim heard by Rabbi Akiva's heroism, Omru, they said, Ma b'ziknuso kach. The Yalduso Alachas Kama Vakama. If a man in his old age can be so careful to surrender his own comfort to do a small mini din de Rabbonon, if he can do that in his old age, imagine what he did when he was younger and stronger and healthier. And also, Umaba Veso Asurim Kach. If this is the way he conducted himself in prison, Shalob Veso Asurim Alachas Kama Vakama. Imagine what he was like when he was not in prison. That's the Gemara. And the Gemara goes on to a discussion of the Tivo Shaddai. But what we have from this is such an important lesson. And it's a lesson in what makes a hero. Right? What makes Rabbi Akiva a hero? You know, you should know, when the Rambam discusses in Hilchos Tanis, the five events that happened on Tisha B'Av. So there was the Bechiya, Shalchinam, in time of the Meraglim. There was the first Chorban. There was the second Chorban. There was Tumas Rufus plowing over the Beis HaMikdash. And one of those five events is the downfall of Beitar. Beitar was the last hope of the Jewish people. And the Rambam says there was a king in Beitar, and of course we know that king was Bar Kochva, Ben Koziba. And the Chachmei Yisrael thought that that king was Mashiach. And of course he means Rabbi Akiva. Akiva thought Bar Kochba was Mashiach. So Rabbi Akiva himself personally felt, you know who's a hero? Bar Kochba is a hero. A great general, a great rebel. He's able to hide in the desert and to cause trouble for the Roman legions. He's able to blow up German tanks, he's able to sabotage bridges, he's able to do all sorts of military exploits. That's a hero. That's how Rabbi Akiva looked at Bar Kochba. But we don't look at Bar Kochba as being a hero. He was a hero, but we don't glorify him, we don't idolize him. We idolize Rabbi Akiva. He was a different kind of a hero. Because a hero is not a person who does once in a while heroic acts. The hero is a person who does the daily small acts, day by day, consistently, every day, Nefilas Yadayim, doesn't miss. Concentration camp, Roman dungeon, he's doing Nefilas Yadayim. That's the hero. That's the hero that we glorify. I mentioned the name Yosef Tzvi Kalbach, the last Rav of Hamburg. He was such a hero. And his daughter, Miriam Gillis, wrote a book about his educational theories. He was an educator. He was a teacher more than a Rav. Called Chinuch Ve'amuna. And he writes about the heroism of the Talmud student. The heroism of a person who studies Talmud. What he means is hero of a person who lives a halachic life, who lives a life of a frum yid. And here's why he writes, she's translated from German to Hebrew. Zeh adam hashakul, hamarusan v'hatzanua. This balanced person, self-controlled, humble. Adam hamavater al kol patos. This man who is not interested in the pathos and the drama of the world, but rather umamaleis chovosov hakatanos hayom yomios. The man who fulfills his small everyday obligations, the osoritzinut shebohu mevatzea maaseh gevura marshim. The man who does his daily activities with the same seriousness that he would do an act of impressive heroism. That's the great man. That's the hero. V'asher ro'eh b'maaseh ha'gadol es miluicho v'aso b'uvad. The person who, when he does do great actions, looks at it, I'm just doing my obligation. I'm not doing anything heroic. Legabov, with reference to such a person, ein hamunachim dvarim gedolim, dvarim ketanim, tofsim. The terms, big things, little things, they don't mean anything for him. He unifies everything into one great harmony. The point of view, what must be done. He does what must be done. Activity or inactivity are not measured by the great consequences, the great accomplishments, but only measured by the standard of fulfilled obligations. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And I'm doing it day by day, day in and day out. That's the hero. One doesn't evaluate lives on the basis of moments, few moments of great climax. No matter how great those climatic moments are, the few moments of great military accomplishment, of great speeches, whatever, that's not how you measure a person's life. It is not the power of the moment or one elevated supreme moment that fixes what is great. But the ability to stand the daily consistent tests of life, that's what makes a great hero. That's the hero. That's what Rabbi Akiva was. Rabbi Akiva was the person who watched until he died every day. Not the person who conquered Roman legions. The person who washed the pillars of time even in the Roman dungeon. Ma beveto asurim kach, shlo beveto asurim alachas kama v'kama. The person who could stand the daily test of time just because it was milui chova. That's what he had to do. And that's what he did. And that's the greatness of Rabbi Akiva. And that's what breaks the mechitza shel barzel. You don't blow up the mechitza shel barzel with dynamite. You blow it up with negelvasa. With the Tilusha Dayan. Avonim Sachakumayim. I came across a beautiful thought from Machshava in the Sefer Sifsei Chaim, Rabbi Chaim Friedlander, whom I quote frequently. In Moadim Gimel, there's this whole section about 3 weeks in Tisha B'Av, and he had an interesting, very, very powerful comments on this kina. This kina is a study of contrasts. The contrasts of leaving Mitzrayim, happy, high, and the contrasts of leaving Yerushalayim, tragic, and low. And the contrast is made. We left Mitzrayim, Moshe was singing, we left Yerushalayim, Yirmiyahu was lamenting, and on and on. But the contrast, notice, it's between Igra Rama, a high roof, and Bira Mikta, a low pit. A contrast of extremes. What about the great middle ground? Right. Are things always either Tzeisim Yimitzrayim, wonderful, or Tzeisim Yerushalayim, unspeakably terrible? What about the whole middle ground? So our Friedlander presents us with a few Ma'amore Chazal and a beautiful Ma'aral, which I'd like to share with you. And I think this too is for the 90s. Maybe more for the 90s, because we are like to be in the middle, center, middle, mediocre. We don't like extremes. Well, here's what Chazal say about this. Gemara, Chagiga, Rebbe Havinokit Sefer Kinnis, Mekakori Begave, Rebbe was holding a kinnis, like everybody here is holding a kinnis. 1800 years ago, Rebbe was sitting and holding the same kinnis. He lived also several generations after the Churban. Of course, he was holding Sefer Echa. Kimotalahai Psuka, when he reached the following pasuk, Hishlich Mishamayim Eretz, God has cast us down from the heaven to the earth. Nofal min yodei, he dropped the kinnis. The kinnis fell out of his hands. Omar, he said, Me igra Roma lebira mikta, from a high roof to a low pit. Or it's not just from a high roof to the ground, but from the high roof to below the ground, to a pit in the ground. This is the epitome of Am Yisrael. Either we're way up on top, or we're way down in the pit. There's no middle ground. Gemara says in Megillah, Umazu Meshul Leofor, Meshul Lakaychovim. We are compared to the dust, we are compared to the stars. When we're down in the dust. When we're up in the stars, and there's no middle ground. And he tells a story, it's a Gemara in Ksuvitz. The story happened, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was riding in a donkey, he was after the Churban. And the students were following him. He saw a young lass, a young girl, who was picking barley out of the dung of donkeys, of the Arab donkeys. When she saw him, she covered her hair and stood up. It's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. When she said to him, Rebbe, upon the same, Rebbe, give me some money, give me some food. He said to her, whose daughter are you? She said to him, Bas Nakhdimun ben Goryan. I am the daughter of Nakhdimun ben Goryan, who was a wealthy, immensely wealthy man. The Churban ruined him, and his daughter is here picking gleanings from the dung of the donkeys, Arab donkeys. So he said to his students, remember when I signed her ksuba. And the ksuba mentioned thousand times a thousand, $1 million of zimra zov was her father's dowry besides her father-in-law's dowry. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai started to cry, and he said, Ashreichem Yisrael. How fortunate are you, O Am Yisrael. When you're up, you're up. When you're down, you're down. So the Maharal in Prague asked the question, Ashreichem Yisrael. A young girl is reduced to gleaning raw barley from the dung, from the excrement of a donkey, and you say, Ashreichem Yisrael. Maharal explained, the nature of Am Yisrael is excellence. Either extreme excellence positive or extreme degradation negative. There's no in between. And when he could see this extreme degradation, this extreme debasement of a Jewish daughter, he realized that that's because the essence of Judaism is the extreme. Now, for temporarily, we are in the extreme negative. But it's just one step, the extreme positive. There's no middle ground. And these are the words of the Maharal. She'ein liYisrael shum madrego beinonis. There's no middle road. O Shehem Moshlim Alakol, O Shehakol Moshlim Aleihem, the words of Maharal. Either they dominate everyone or they are dominated by everyone. What this means for us is there's no halfway. There's no halfway. There's no mediocrity. There's no middle road. You're either right or you're wrong. You're either good or you're evil. That's the derech. There's no beinonis. In modern Hebrew, there's a term, beinonius, middleness, which translates into English as mediocrity. But it's not the way it is for us. It's excellent. Either we're a star or we're in the dust. And hopefully, we're stars. And this is why in this kinah, it's either b'tzeifim yimisroyim, or b'tzeifim yirushalayim, or, as it ends, b'shuvi yirushalayim, return to Yerushalayim. I'll introduce you to a melody which I heard. I understand I don't sing it correctly, but my forgiveness, I ask forgiveness of those who sing it correctly, and I'll sing it my way, because it's too old, too late to teach me new tunes. And just join in as we go along. It starts, of course, on a high note, and then it ends on a sad note. Each stanza, high, low, high, low, high, low. Heishtu kazakirvi v'halosi alibi v'tzeifimi v'tzroyim kinev oiro v'man akiro tzeifimi rushaloyim oz yashir moshe shilo yinoshe tzeifimi v'tzroyim. In the middle of the 17th century, in 1648 and 1649, there were horrible pogroms. I spoke of them at great length at other times. And the survivors of that, those pogroms included the great Rabbeinu Yom Tov Lipman Heller, who was a great student of the Maharam in Prague. He was a Rav, first in Prague and later in Krakow. He's buried in his grave stands to this day in Krakow. And he wrote the famous commentary on the Mishnayos called Tosfos Yom Tov and other commentaries, and he wondered, why on earth is it that the Jews have suffered such pogroms? Why is it that the shuls have been burnt and the shuls have been destroyed? And he said, perhaps, the shuls have been destroyed because we didn't treat them correctly, because we weren't quiet sufficiently, we talked, We abused the shuls. We didn't treat them with the proper dignity, the proper kavod beis hakneses. And perhaps that is why we talk during our prayers, we don't pray properly. Perhaps that's the reason for our punishment. And as a response, he authored the following Mishaberach, which we recite here in shul a couple of times a year. If we recite it every day or every Shabbos, it would probably wear off. But once in a while we recite it, and we recite it today. And I'd like to ask you all to recite it aloud with me. And I'll translate it phrase by phrase. Mishaberach Avoseinu Avraham Yitzchak V'Yaakov. He who has blessed our forefathers Avraham, Yitzchak and Yaakov, Moshe V'Aaron David Shlomo. Uyivorech et kol mi sheshomer piv l'shono shelo l'daber b'eis ha'tfilah. May he bless everybody who's careful not to speak during the davening. HaKadosh Baruch Hu yishmereyu mikol tzora v'tzuka. U'mikol nego machla. May God save him from all kinds of trouble and illness. V'yachulu olof kol habrochos haksuvos b'sefer taras Moshe Rabbeinu v'chol sifrei ha'neviyim v'haksuvim. May all the blessings written in the Torah and in the Neviim Ksuvim take effect upon him. And may he be privileged to see children, living, healthy children. And may he be privileged to raise them to be students of Torah, to be married under the chuppah, to do good mitzvot. May he be able to have the koach to worship God forever, with truth and with perfection, the Nomar Amen. In the lifetime of some of us, myself included, but certainly in the lifetime of our fathers and grandfathers, occurred the most horrible event in all of Jewish history. You might ask, how can I say that? After all, Tisha B'Av is about the first Churban, the second Churban. Is this worse than that? A quote from a little pamphlet of a great man, still living, Baruch Hashem, Hashem Yarich Yomor V'Shnosov, the Slonim Rebbe, familiar to many of us as the author of his works, which are now being published, Nesivos Shalom, Rebbe Yerushalayim, who has written numerous essays on the Shoah. He was in Eretz Yisrael during the Shoah. He was spared. He writes, "Bivoenu lehisamei kulaharer b'chol hanogeya lehashmoda hanatis." When we come to reflect profoundly upon everything about the Nazi genocide, "Ein anu motzeim shum bitui v'hagdora holemes l'metziuso." We find no proper expression, no way of putting into words this horrible reality. Ha'ayumo mikol oyom, which is most terrible of all terrible things. Ha'hekef v'ha'omek shel ha'tragedia hanoro ha'me eivel l'chol dimyon u'machshavo enoshis. The scope and depth of this horrible tragedy are beyond all imagination and all human thought. Kol ha'teyurim ha'mezazim v'hashichorim minei shachor. All the descriptions, as horrible as they are and as black as they are, pale toward the actual reality. Machavirim lamul ha'metziyus ho'achzoris kishihili atzma. The descriptions, as black as they are white compared to what actually happened. Kol tiga'ei ha'olam hazeh. Yesh mehem ketanim, yesh gedolim, yesh hamagiyim nasi. All horrible things in the world, there are small ones, great ones, and climactic ones. Yesh rishus, there is cruelty. Yesh achzorius, there is sadism. V'yesh yis'alulustitnis ablasai, nasi. And there is satanic torture until the peak. V'ulam kol mashi hisrachesh b'tekubas ha'shoah. But whatever happened during the Shoah, during the Holocaust, is above all that. Hu inyan shelamala mikol mitzius. It's above everything that's ever happened. Miyom b'ro elokim adam b'tzalmo. From the day that man, that God created man in his image, there's been nothing as horrible as that. This is just one paragraph from a pamphlet that Slonim Rebbe published called Haharuga Olecha. It's a story from a collection by Ida Fink, herself a survivor of the Shoah, in a book called A Scrap of Time. And in the story, the two parents talk about how sorry they are that they had this little girl. They had her late in their life. They weren't sure they should conceive her, but she was conceived. And now the town is being rounded up by the Nazis to be deported from the railroad station to Belzec. They were walking in the direction of the railroad station through the town, which had been washed clean by the night's pouring rain and was as quiet and peaceful as it always was on a Sunday morning. They walked without speaking, already stripped of everything human. Even despair was mute. It lay like a death mask, frozen and silent on the face of the crowd. The man and his wife and child walked along the edge of the road by the sidewalk. He was carrying the little girl in his arms. The child was quiet, both arms wrapped around her father's neck. The man and his wife no longer spoke. They had said their last words in the house when the door crashed open, kicked in by the boot of an SS man. He had said then to the child, "Don't be afraid. I'll carry you in my arms." Then they left the house for the last journey. For 3 hours, they stood in the square, surrounded by a heavy escort. They were mute, they were deaf, they were blind. At 10 o'clock, they set out. His legs were tired, his hands were numb, but he didn't put the child down, not even for a minute. He knew it was only an hour or so till they reached the fields near the station. The child in his arms felt heavier and heavier, but not because of her weight. He turned his head slightly and brushed the little girl's cheek with his lips, a soft, warm cheek. In an hour or two, he bent toward the child again, seeking the strength that flowed from her silky, warm young body. He still didn't know what he would do. But he did know that he had to find some chink through which he could push his child back into the world of the living. He was thinking very fast. "Don't be afraid," he whispered. "Do what Papa tells you. Over there, near the church, there are a lot of people. They are going to pray. They are standing on the sidewalk in the yard in front of the church. When we get there, I'm going to put you down on the ground. You're little. No one will notice you. Then you'll ask somebody to take you to Marcisha, the milkmaid, outside of town. She'll take you in. Or maybe one of these people will take you home. Do you understand what Papa said?" The little girl looked stunned. Still, he knew she had understood. "You'll wait for us. We'll come back after the war, from the camp," he added. "That's how it has to be, darling. It has to be this way," he whispered quickly, distractedly. "That's what you'll do. You have to obey Papa." Everything swam before his eyes. The image of the world grew blurry. He saw only the crowd in the churchyard. The sidewalk beside him was full of people. He was brushing against them with his sleeve. It was only a few steps to the churchyard gate. The crush of people was greatest there and salvation most likely. "Go straight to the church," he whispered, and put the child down on the ground. He didn't look back. He didn't see where she ran. He walked on stiffly at attention, his gaze fixed on the pale spring sky in which the white threads of a cloud floated like a spiderweb. He walked on, whispering a kind of prayer, beseeching God and men. He was still whispering when the air was rent by a furious shriek. "Ein jüdisches Kind!" A Jewish child. He was still whispering when the sound of a shot cracked like a stone hitting water. He felt his wife's fingers, trembling and sticky from sweat. She was seeking his hand like a blind woman. He heard her faint, whimpering moan. Then he fell silent and slowly turned around. At the edge of the sidewalk lay a small, bloody rag. The smoke from the shot hung in the air, wispy, already blowing away. He walked over slowly, and those few steps seemed endless. He bent down, picked up the child, stroked the tangle of blonde hair. "Dinah, is it yours?" He answered loud and clear, "Yeah, Mina." And then softly to her, "Forgive me." He stood there with his child in his arms and waited for a second shot. But all he heard was a shout, and he understood that they would not kill him here, that he had to keep on walking, carrying his dead child. "Don't be afraid. I'll carry you," he whispered. The procession moved on like a gloomy gray river flowing out to sea. Hazocher Mazkirov, Dor Dor Uktoshov, Yeis Asher Oz Bechatanu, Yizkor Deraon Sheldor Acharon Oyo Mahayolanu. God who remembers all previous generations, remember the horror of this last generation. Zechor HaNa'okos V'rash Tz'okos Oz Yuvlu Boretzach Ye'orei D'mehem V'dimos P'nehem Losi Shochach Nomonetzach. Their screams, their cries, they were let to be killed. Don't let them be forgotten. Kol chil u'negicha u'nehi tzricha mishidude lahakos haklovim zechor u'sfor v'nodcho tzror hadeis nekol malbon aluvim. Remember the screeches and screams when they were attacked by mad dogs. Remember and keep their tears in your flask. V'machnos hakroim ke'ev u'negoim u'frachem u'frashos agumos. Remember the camps, the shame, the embarrassment, the spitting in the face. Hunger and thirst, and madness and sadness. Don't forget. Simrot Hashem v'kitur mikivshon tilei tilei matzamos v'gidim v'chadrei hora'al kol sh'ogos mikahal ha'nechanokim tov to'ei o'idim. Pillars of smoke coming out of furnaces, mounds upon mounds, bones and sinews, gas chambers, and the sound of suffocating cries. V'siyachon gufos v'viyos gufos kol aldomen admas no'atzim e'chofchu torfeihem v'rorischo v'yem v'orishu kishutei ha'noshim. Remember the stagnant bodies, the stinking bodies, the fertilizer of which they made us, and how those who pounced upon us turned our fat into soap and our hides into decorations for women. Remember the motions of the finger of Mengele to the right for hard work, to the left for death, and how they shot us as we were digging our own graves. Remember how they raped our sisters, castrated our daughters, sterilized our daughters, and gave poison to us at the hands of cruel doctors, and how some of us hid in monasteries and churches, never to be found as Jews. Your perfect sheep have become sanctifiers of your name. The Kol Shema Yisrael, Masrun Af Nefesh Lo'el, Shuhu Yasfein V'yad Yom Acharon, Hasfiku Din V'afanim Amin Anu V'shoru Shiras Nitzachon. With the sound of Shema Yisrael, they gave their lives over. They said that God was right. And they even sang Ani Ma'amin. They sang the last song of faith. V'chein nisharam ki yasom nitom b'lik yivorim nehishtateach. V'lom atevos, they fold his coast, yivavos levavoseach. And now we are left an orphaned nation without graves upon which to pray, without monuments where to cry. Rak nisrei hadom azkarosom has a symbol ishocheach. Puddles of blood are their memorials, bubbling without being forgotten. Through most of and their ashes, the ashes of the altar. Minyam aleil tzar Yisrael asher dato mikeiv nitrofes, mikeiv nitrofes. Who can express Jewish pain? How our glory, how our pride has been bent. Merciful God, have pity upon those of us who remain and who search and seek and long for you. Or chodosh tatsriach, may a new light shine. Kaneho tatsmiach, may a new rays of light shine forth. Ruach Elohim rachefes, the Spirit of God hovers. I'd like to say some concluding words about the concluding kina before we sing it together. And we sing it. We sing Eli Tzion Dioreh. It's interesting, and I don't mean this at all disrespectfully, but of all that I've learned from Rav Soloveitchik, and I was not a student of his, I think he attended his yeshiva, but I went to some of his shiurim, and over the past some years now, I've listened to probably hundreds of his tape recordings. So I learned a great deal from him, but I never thought I would learn from him something about Medina, about music. I didn't think Rav Soloveitchik was much of a singer. And having married into a family of one of the most famous singers of the Jewish people, the Rebbes of the Hasidus of Majid, I was so moved to hear him talk about the time he visited a Majid Shtibel in Warsaw. And the Shtibel and the people who lived in the Shtibel were killed. Rav Soloveitchik left Poland long before that and survived. But he sings the tune of Eli Tzion V'Oreho and points out that many shuls, most shuls, sing that tune for the Chod Odi on Shabbos Chazon. He sang it, Hillel sang it for the Chod Odi, the same tune. Chod Odi V'Gras Kalom. He also pointed out something that you hadn't realized, that we sing it on Yom Tov too, every Yom Tov. V'Neve Yitzchok V'Atchila, V'Choneg Mitzoshcha V'Mechono. How do you say it? V'Neve Yitzchok V'Atchila. That's the tune of Eli Tzion V'Oreho. And we sing it to the Neve Yitzchok V'Atchila on Yom Tov. What is the significance of this? So he says, this is really beautiful, really worthy of the person who said it. Eli, that term, as I tried to point out to you earlier this morning, is a term of ongoing mourning. We get up and we say this as our last kina, and we sing it. You know why? Not because we're finished, but because we're not finished. Because we'll never be finished. We'll never be finished crying. And so for our last kina, we use the word Eli, which means eternally crying, forever crying, no boundary, no gvul, we're crying forever. We're crying on the Shabbos before, and we'll be crying this coming Sukkot and Pesach and Shavuot. The same cry. Kamo Yishov Tzireha. Our crying has no control. Try to control a woman in her birth pangs and tell her, it'll be okay, control yourself. You can't. She cries in a pain that we men can't imagine. Her Yishov Tzireha, her birth pangs are such that she must cry, she can't stop. Imagine a psula, a virginal bride, who is mourning her husband, Nureha. Imagine, she went to the chuppah, and her husband died, coming away from the chuppah. The marriage was never consummated. She's a psula chagura sak. She was a psula, a virginal bride, clothed in sackcloth, mourning Talmureha. That woman will never stop crying. That woman will cry forever and ever. And so we cry forever and ever. And that's the difference, Soloveitchik says, between the Avelos, the mourning of today, of Tisha B'Av, and the mourning that we mourn when we lose a close one, a spouse, a parent, a child. There's the laws of Avelos, and there's laws of Avelos. There's Avelos Yishona, Avelos, old Avelos, historical Avelos, today, Tisha B'Av. And there's Avelos Chadosha, there's Avelos that when we mourn personal loss of a close one. There are many differences in halacha between Avelos Yishona, Avelos Chadosha, historical mourning and personal mourning. And here's one major difference. When it comes to personal mourning, Ein bochim av hameis yaser mishlosha yomim. It's the Rambam in Hilchos Avel, Perek Yud Gimel Halacha Yud. One is not to cry more than 3 days. Ve'ein maspidin yaser mishiva. And one is not to deliver hespid more than 7 days. This is true of all people, Talmidei Chachamim, Hakol lefi chachmasam. You may give a hespid on the great Chacham a month or two after he dies. A week or two after he dies. However, the Ein Bochin Aleihem Yosef Mishloshim Yom, 30 days after death, you don't cry for anyone. She'ein Lonu Gadol Mimoshe Rabbeinu. There was no one greater than Moshe. Uchsiv Vayitimu Yimei V'chiyeva Moshe. Yet, the days of mourning for Moshe were over. When they're over, they're over. Al Yizkasha Adam HaMeso Yosef Midai. It's forbidden to mourn too much. The Patek says in Yumiya. Don't mourn too much. Why? This is a powerful phrase in the Rambam. Shezehu min hago shalolam. That's the way of the world. People die. V'hametzaer atzmo yoser al min hago shalolam. Al min hago shalolam. If a person is upset about the way of the world, he's upset, he doesn't like the way the world is, he doesn't like the fact that people die, harei zeh tipesh. Rambam says, he's a fool. Halakeitad yase, what do you do? Shlosha lebechi, for 3 days you cry. Shiva lehesped, 7 days you deliver eulogies. Shloshim yom letisporas, 30 days you don't shave. And then a year for your parents, and then you go on with your life. You stop mourning. That's Avelus Chadosha, that's personal mourning. However, when it comes to mourning for the Beis HaMikdash, there's no such thing. 3 days, 7 days, 30 days, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, 2,000 years, you still go on mourning. But you keep on mourning, you continuously mourn. That is the enduring mourning. That's Adkan Ras Elevation. I would like to just add a little bit. And that is, the difference is this. We stop mourning for our dead relatives, our dead brothers, sisters, husbands, fathers, wives. You know why? Because we give up ever getting them back. We realize they're gone. Until Tchias HaMeisim, they're gone. And the rest of our lives, we're not going to see them. So our mourning can stop because Gzeir al HaMeis, Nishtakach Nalev. We forget, we move on, that's natural. The Rambam says, Nehago Shalolam. When we realize there's no hope, they're not coming back from the grave, then we go further and stop mourning. But for the Beis HaMikdash, there is hope. There's always hope. This hope of the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt tomorrow. And therefore, because there's always hope, there's always pain. It's like Yaakov always mourned for Yosef, because he knew in his heart of hearts that Yosef wasn't dead, so he kept on mourning. The Beis HaMikdash is not dead. There's a Mechitza Shel Barzel. There's an iron curtain that's blocking it. But there are ways through the Iron Curtain. Fasting is a way through the Iron Curtain. Tshuva is a way through the Iron Curtain. Stucco is a way through the Iron Curtain. We get past the Iron Curtain, the hope is there. And because there's enduring hope, there's enduring mourning. Because there's enduring mourning, there's enduring hope.
Abal Yureho, Alegalus Mishor Sayel, Anime Shir Timureho, Yaldabom Asher Shukach,
From the Chumah to Simcha to the Gula Shleimah.